thank you. It's great to be here, Val, and thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it.
I might start with a poem I like starting with. It's a narrative poem. There's a mention of the Yarra, which is a river that runs through Melbourne, and that's about all you need to know. Following the many elbows of the Yarra, taking the racing line, retracing the route to the Turek school that did not teach but bequeathed a tie. Perhaps I was blinded by the nostalgia of a life half-lived, perhaps, and did not see the vixen spirit herself across the road just in time to feel the bite of my tires. There was no time to break. My foot was half on, half off the accelerator when I felt the shock of her through my steering wheel. Heard her cry. I could have kept driving into the night. The road was dead, the streets asleep. But could not forget that time when coming down Brown Mountain in a Toyota, killed a goanna and kept going. Lacked the decency to drag her carcass off the road. And how I carried that sin in my glove compartment still. I stopped, stepped out into the early morning, the air cold enough to turn breath to steam, and stood by the taillights of my old 318. Watched the fox lie in the glare of a street light half a world away from her natural home, and felt something close to pity. Waited until a fleeting shadow, at first an eclipse, grew smaller, darker, then manifested as a wedge-tailed eagle that landed on the double white line without a sound, wingtips sweeping the leaves from the blue-black road. The eagle was telling me she was watching me watch the fox. So now I knew I had no choice. I had to act. I left my car behind, purring its soft red cloud of carcinogens, and heard my boots strike the bitumen as I drew close enough to see my animus reflected in her animal eye. The vixen was breathing, more like panting, and unable to move more than her head. Without thinking, I reached down to touch her burnt orange fur, but she had seen enough of my kind on her backyard travels, and throwing her head up, caught my thumb in the trap of her razor teeth. What happened next surprised us all. Without speaking, I took off my old school tie to bind my bleeding hand, walked back to the car, popped the boot, and came back to the fox with the wheel jack swinging low from my good hand. Then let that hand rise and fall beneath the shadow of the street light, and listened to the sound of steel splintering bone while the eagle lifted herself from the road to seek solace in the sky. Thank you. That was from Year of the Wasp, which is my most recent collection. Year of the Wasp was written after I had a stroke. I'm telling you that so I can read you the next poem. When I was in hospital, I couldn't walk and I couldn't speak properly. A number of things happened. And at one point, I started thinking about transfiguration, becoming something else, and ultimately becoming nothing. And I also, one night, I was pretty sure I saw a wasp in the ward. This was in the middle of the Australian winter. A wasp in the ward above my bed. Although, you know, could have been a Black Hawk helicopter for all I know, I was so out of it. And so I started writing poems afterwards when I tried to figure out whether or not I was a poet still. So I'm going to read a couple of poems from the first section, which deals with that. There's a few things I'll just mention up. These are poems without titles, and they're sort of individual poems, but they're related as well. I'll read you a couple of those. There's mention of Typhonus. Typhonus is, this is one of the Greek myths. He asked the gods for eternal life, but forgot to ask for eternal youth, which was a really bad call. And I'll just read you some poems, a couple of these. South of Ship, the Renault punched a hole, the shape of the first man in a storm of locusts, confirming the irrigation flats as God's chosen wasteland. At the base hospital, the old man was sleeping, hooked up like a cow in the shed for milking. The sun domed the cap of his father's freckled skull with the cup of the palm of his hand. Watched him breathe like a toothless babe. The air conditioning was far too cold. It was foolish to hope. He prayed for rain, but the heavens let fall Typhonus instead, whose every atom was transfigured into a wasp, and every wasp was born in fury, and showered down and stung and did not slake the thirst, made unbelievers believe, lured the fervent into car parks, seeking rapture, where the wasps, not the Lord, were waiting. And the supplicant, whose waking prayer invited wrath, did not run, did not dare. Neither fervent nor fallen, he knew better than to quit kneeling in his suburban driveway. Knew safety to be mythology, a place sustained by misplaced belief. Stay put instead, eyes closed, like a child counting down from 10 to 1 before it is time to seek. The owl floats across the darkened ward, lands on the metal bed head with a click. Stares, does not blink, at the face shining on the pillow, white as a pharmaceutical moon. Asks, did you fall? And the face replies, but first I flew. At which the owl nods, that much is true. What falls must first fly. Shifts claw to claw, then decides, but I have only ever flown, and blinks and hops onto the pillow, baits her beak with his lazy eye. And the face screams, wait, how could you never fall? And the owl does not blink, does not speak, but claws her answer into his skin. Won't read too many of these. I'm a miserable prick. At least that's what my wife tells me. I might actually, I'll read you the last poem in this collection, seeing as my wife's not here. I met my wife when I was 17, and one of her complaints in recent years has been that I don't write her any more love poetry. And so the last poem I wrote for this collection, which I'm about to read you, was a love poem, and I wrote it and I shoved it in her face and I was like, here's your fucking love poem. So here it goes. How could you not love me? What makes the heart grow? It's not absence, no, but the penumbra of your presence. That is not to say our love is without flaw. Those days when your anger lingers in the bedroom like cordite. Those nights when the acid of my soul spills out of me, burns through the gristle, bone and skin of me, scorches the carpet. Which is how it should be, I suppose, because life is combat and love a fortress from the fray. And the stones of our tower, cut by hand, are not square, but mirroring the undulations of your beauty, pleasing to my eye. And the fires within these walls will not sleep until we can no longer wake. I would like to say otherwise, so that such a day shall never come, that our time will be unending, our fires an eternity of sunsets as luminous and unyielding as napalm. But I cannot. There are no happy endings. There is no life eternal. There is only grace ephemeral. Remember Box Hill Hospital? How the doctor showed in real time the ultrasound of my beating heart, pointed out the tendril scar wrapped ghostly round each greyscale chamber, tracing the betrayal, she said. A time when the involuntary muscle almost failed to meet its duty. And as she spoke, I relieved, I did. The years and months, days and hours of that great unhappiness that never turned, thickening the blood until it ceased. My heart was that frail, that feckless. And that is why I will not beg for mercy, beg the fates for mercy, for one day more than is my due. As for the gods, who knows? Perhaps they now reside in open source software rather than our hearts, which are full enough for now. And so I pray to the digital celestials to program me this day my daily bread, and should tomorrow come, to give me the love I have loved all my adult days, so that I might watch her clockwise shadow track the diurnal passage of the chariot of the sun. And that will have to be enough, it will. For though we have no time to live, we have just enough time to love. Thank you. I had 6 funerals last year. One of them was my father. This is an old poem, but it's appropriate. Requiem. Perhaps those archetypes of immortality, the beautiful doomed, have a story to tell after all, that there is only now. No golden afternoon just gone. No promise of a silver morning, that they are not forever young, suspended in telegenic animation, but forever dead instead. That unless phrenology has moved on from the so-called science of the mind to yet another mismeasure of mankind, the dead are beyond our vanities. And that if anything matters, if anything does in the long, slow fuck of life, a car crash and time lapse, where our family sedan slews off the shoulder of the highway, over and down, down and over the embankment, gathering turds of sod in its seams, as it gathers momentum towards a barbed wire fence, fencing in a gouged creek and orchards burn grey by salt. If there is anything to be learned from these revolutions, these guttural exclamations, as our bodies penetrate other bodies, a perforate themselves, as a concussion of our man-made capsules colliding against the blunt trauma of Earth continues for a time less than we imagined, for longer than we thought possible. If there is anything to be learned, it is this. What matters most is that we love this life we are leaving and are unafraid of the next. I've had a really good week in Cork. Tonight's my last night, and one of the things I went to as much of the Cork Festival as I could, the Poetry Festival, which is quite a treasure, and also with young Mr. John Lee over here, did some work on some poetry. So hope you don't mind, I'm going to test drive some new poetry. Food court. Apologies, John, if you've heard this. I smell before I see my father. Bloated maggots for company. Wrapped in a shroud of cockroaches, ants, flies. The lunchtime crowd steers clear of dad. Considers the purge leaking from his gut territorial waters. And it occurs to me as I breach the thin yellow line of cleaning staff. Amenity technicians, they're called. It occurs to me that death does not smell as advertised. Cold, stale, gone. No. Death smells like sex gone bad. Hot, rank, here. And today death is my father, who is visiting, he says, to lay by a new suit of clothes. Lunch tray. I don't like crowds, says my son as he eats my father. They make me feel disconnected. He chews with a frown, hooks gristle with a finger, leaves it on the table, pushes back his chair. Lunch trays swirl past, a stream around his tone. We are good people. Recycle. Use bamboo utensils. Drink tap water. Finish what we start. So I know without asking, what is the matter? Nothing tastes like family. The package announces its impending arrival with a text, departing depot, followed by two more, en route, arrival imminent. Shut up, I reply. It's midwife, a man from Mumbai called Betty, who hates cricket, meets me at the front door when I answer the bell. Does not smile, so I do. Tells me to sign in the box on the screen of his smart gadget, so I do. Pinching the plastic stick as I scroll carefully, help, inside the space. Betty doesn't notice, says, thanks mate, in an ironic tone. Barrels away in a battered van, accelerating down the Big Dipper of Winter's Way, like a ski jumper gathering speed for liftoff. And now, having stuck its landing in my entryway, it waits upon me, crowds me. What should I do? Push it outside, deadbolt the door, someone might notice, might complain. Leave it inside. I've streamed enough Brad Pitt movies to know what happens next. Even if this horse is a cardboard box. And isn't that what happens anyway, every Christmas morning? Every birthday? My children skin the wrapping, dismember the Trojan boxes. Until the house is overrun with long-haired Achaeans reborn as plastic toys. Which makes my wife, Diane Kruger, me a withered Orlando Bloom. Tell my invader the walls of Troy were made of Lego. Drag it into the lounge. Sit in a chair with a thin chest high before me. It is addressed to me without a return egg. A white sticker on the top has a printout of numbers and a barcode. One corner accordion by four. I worry the damaged corner with a finger until the cardboard tears. Pull out a polystyrene chip. Bite without breaking it with my teeth. Think of Cheetos. Spit the chip under the carpet. It rouses Argos. Lying on the courtyard stones in the sun, she fights to all fours, limps inside. Sniffs all corners of the newcomer in search of a traveller not yet returned. Snaps up the chip with her teeth. Out I command. So Argos shuffles back into the stanzas of another poem, leaving us alone. I stare at it, wait upon it. Decide fate delayed is fate delivered and attack it. Engage in hand-to-hand combat, steering, starting at the seams, moving to the ruptured corner until disemboweled, a mess of polystyrene spills across the carpet. Surrenders another unmarked box. This one made of maple. Taken from a tree wilder than the tame specimens now kept in plantations. Not lacquered, sanded smooth to the touch. I lift it clear, feel its dead weight, place it on a clean patch of floor. It is a perfect cube, a conundrum without seams. Hollow when I knock it, warm as a woman when I hold it, hard as love when I take a knife to it. I give up. Make a mug of tea and sit on it and fall into a doze. Dream of her face, the one that launched 1,000 ships in the breast that sheathed a husband's sword. I'm still there when woken by the silver lips of fair Selene. What time is it, I ask, and she points to a full-blood moon that has climbed to that fortress in the tower of the sky where it holds the sun at bay. That early, I asked. And she shakes her head ruefully. Confused, I stand as the cube opens like a broken fist. Smell, then see, then hold. The dark soil of fate and know is never that early, is forever that late. A lot of poetry this week. I think I should probably flog you too much more. We're getting a bit late. We got one more?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me see. Do one more. I do write a fair bit of political poetry too. Ex-political person. As the last one. just to explain, this is an ekphrastic poem which a friend of mine is an artist. He wrote, he did a drawing of a during World War II, when they were firebombing the Japanese cities, the kids were given these hooded, these little cotton hoodies to wear, and they were told it was going to keep them safe. And a friend of mine did a, William Kelly did a drawing of these, and they're called Bokuzuken. And it's quite haunting because it's just this drawing of a, basically a hoodie that of course kept nobody safe. Let us talk of Knoxville, Tennessee, and summer nights lying sweet and low in the long grass, listening to the softwood trees read James again. Let's talk about talking about the futility of fences and barefoot children and parents unbuttoned to belts that no longer feel the need to whip clean dirty brown legs. Let us jump up and bless ourselves with the sprinkler and coil the hose tight. Let us lie down and think but not speak, not one word, about the glow on the horizon we took to be the sun rising, but was instead Tokyo burning. Let us and our children and our children's children not be burned to the bone. Let us talk about the sorrow of being. Let us waterboard General LeMay until he explains how a killer is a hero, is a father, is a son. Let us pilot a drone in Afghanistan from a penny arcade in Anaheim. Let us ride Magic Mountain until the trees run out of leaves. Let us fly under 5,000 feet so they can feel our engines humming. Hear the whiz of each and every M69. Let us explain that what we did was not Guernica, not Bergen-Belsen, not Dresden. It was not war, nor terror, nor crime, just slaughter. Let us argue at The Hague that the prisoners of Manus Island are not people, but haunted Bokuzuken, and that what is hidden beneath those hoods is no longer human. Let us believe that a quilted kimono with a cotton mask is protection against the firestorm that is to come when the cities of the world fall through the floor of the world. Let us give thanks for that which we shall receive when they who shall be slaughtered in our name are led into that abattoir of good intentions. Let us walk empty streets with the stars for judgment and through steaming breath quote Heinrich Heine and recite Slaughterhouse-Five verbatim. Let us crash land our Biko, that great shining silver fortress, silver fish of a super fortress in the black waters off Manhattan, and know that Reznikov was right. Let us admit that, yes, that was chaos through which we stumbled. That is chaos. We cast our eyes back upon, and chaos it is that shall forever remain. Thank you.